Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, I'm Ross Kemp. Over the last 18 years, I've made some 90-odd documentaries predominantly in hostile environments, from Afghanistan to Syria, from El Salvador to the Congo. And it's fair to say that during that time, I found myself in a few interesting situations. I've been shot at, tear gassed, had knives pulled on me, and spears thrown at me. But in all those years, what's impressed me the most is the resilience of the human spirit. Our ability, no matter where we're from, to overcome and make it through to the other side. So, in my new series, The Kemp Cast, I'll be talking to some incredible individuals who all have engaging stories to tell and have themselves overcome some extremely tough moments in their lives. Right now, we're living in unprecedented times, and we should be doing all we can together to get through this as safely as possible. I hope that if you subscribe to The Kemp Cast and hear how my guests overcame their toughest moments, it may help you overcome yours, whether you're going through one right now or you're faced with one in the future.
Joining me today is Mark Dempster, a former addict. He's now an addiction specialist and author. He spent years addicted to drugs and alcohol, which eventually led him to dealing, drug smuggling, prison, and homelessness. Mark, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. We met through Russell, didn't we?
Aye, Russell's house, yeah.
Yeah, Russell Brand, top man.
I love him.
Yeah, very, very kind man. I love him dearly. You're now an addiction specialist, Mark. Yeah. You've had a very interesting life.
Yeah.
You know, you have been an addict, not only of alcohol, but also many, many different types of drugs, I guess. Can we all become addicts?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? It's a good question because I think we've got the propensity as human beings. We, you know, if you look at society as a whole, where we are now, we've got the highest rates of obesity, we've got the highest rates of credit card debt, you know, shopping. And if we look across the board, right, of what people do to fix any uncomfortable feelings or continue a compulsive behaviour, there's so many different areas that people fix on. Now, of course, you know, some of them are, as I said just before our interview started here, some of them are very socially accepted addictions, like the pursuit of money, right? The pursuit of fame, the pursuit of, you know, kudos, prestige. So that, you know, the chief exec of a company who works 14 hours or 16 hours a day is not necessarily looked at as an addict. He's looked at as a very successful businessman.
Yeah.
His family have been neglected, right? So he doesn't see his kids. He never puts them, he doesn't bath them. He's got nannies looking after them. Do you know, he's, you know, they hardly ever see him. He hardly sees his wife. His wife starts having an affair. You know, like, you know, you think about, so does everybody have an addictive personality? I think...
Or the propensity to become an addict.
Propensity, oh, yeah. I think, right, you know that thing they say, Ross, about... They do these twin studies in Sweden, and they took, you know, so they took children from addicts, from addictive families, and then they put them in, those children into non-addictive families. And they came up with like 50%, right? And then they do this thing called the marshmallow test. Have you ever heard of the marshmallow test where...
Tell me.
The marshmallow test is where you get a group of kids in a school. What they done years ago is they looked through two-way glass and they watched and they said to the kids that are all sitting in the classroom, they said, okay, you can have one marshmallow now, or if you wait 20 minutes, you can have two marshmallows, right, when the teacher comes back. And they watched the class, and they done this with long-term studies of the kids, and they could see the kids that went straight for the one marshmallow, immediate gratification thing, just, you know, they obviously didn't have the skills, the tenacity or the resilience to delay the gratification at that time, right? And they watched the kids who delayed it, and they were like tapping on the desk, they were whistling, they were doing like, they were developing strategies to delay the gratification. And then they followed up and watched the kids who delayed the gratification 20 years, 25 years later. And of course, they had been much more successful in a number of different areas in their life, around relationships, around career. The kids that just went for that impulsive, quick hit. And it's pleasure, isn't it? They're just, you know, so what makes us, you know, what makes some of us, you know, an addict? So they say there's a predisposing gene, right? So I've got an alcoholic father, an alcoholic grandfather. So the likelihood is I've got the predisposing gene. But not necessarily do I become an addict, right? Because then you've got to think of what's the perfect storm for it, you know? So early trauma, childhood trauma.
Well, you had that, didn't you?
I had a violent father, at times violent father, volatile.
I mean, a lot of the beginning of your book,
yeah,
is talking about that time. There was your mum trying to hold it together, but your dad was an addict. And you could say, some people will be listening to this and going, oh, that, you know, he was intent on destroying himself and his family, or maybe he was just sick, right?
Yeah.
People see it in very different ways. And I don't think that view has changed even today, even though, you know, that happened a long time ago, particularly, you know, particularly in sort of working class or unemployed areas of Britain. And it's still happening today. And it may not be alcohol, it may be another substance. But it happens. So you talk about Glasgow and you talk about, you know, the sort of depression that affected the area when the industry went down there.
Shipbuilding gone, yeah, all that, yeah. No hope. People then confined into high-rise blocks. So if you look at the, you know, if you just take the perfect storm again, right, you then, it's like the Rat Park story as well. But basically, and I'll come back to that if we get the chance about Rat Park, but you put people in high-rise buildings, right, no hope for the future, no possibility of employment. So social deprivation coupled with confined into small spaces, and then you throw in some drugs or alcohol in amongst it all, you've got like the perfect storm. And that's what happened to Glasgow, and that's what happened to a lot of these cities, the northern cities, Liverpool, Manchester. You see it, it's like London was, you know, the same to, you know, and so especially up there, what happened. And then you've got the sectarianism, you've got the bitterness, you know, I guess some of the transgenerational influences that get passed down, yeah, from one parent group, you know, like one generation to the next, about, you know, the anti-English thing, or, you know, the especially amongst maybe the Catholics.
Or your team, yeah, whether it's blue, whether it's green and white.
Yeah. I agree, way the Celtic Rangers thing. We hate that. We hate the Protestants.
But all of that, a lot of that, and I'm not going to generalise. A lot of that is deflecting the fact that if I can't be proud of the fact that I can go to work and earn a job to fulfil the fact that I can have my pint at the end of the day, then I will be the toughest bloke in that pub, or I'll be the best criminal around, or I will earn my kudos in another way.
Yeah.
Because, do you know what? There isn't an opportunity. There isn't an opportunity for me to go and put rivets in the side of a ship.
Yes. Yeah.
True or
yeah.
not?
Yeah. Oh, no, no, no. And then if you think about, okay, so as a man, you know, this is when it gets a bit deeper, isn't it? Like, okay, so my sense of value as a man, then if I'm not inheriting that from, you know, we get mostly our self-esteem from the work that we do and from our relationship, our intimate relationship. So if I'm not, you know, if I've not got a relationship or a woman who sort of, I'm not saying it should always be validated by your partner or your wife, but if you don't feel that sense of acceptance from that area and you've not got a job, then you're going to be really, you're likely to be quite shaky and insecure. And then you know, and then you've got role models that, I mean, look at within particular communities, what kind of sort of role models then you gravitate to where you're not encouraged to have healthy sort of role models, you know, because it's not seen as cool. People want to be tough, want to be hard, looking up to particular. Now, one of my friends, Paul Ferris, was a gangster back then, and he, you know, so a lot of people would look up to him and go, oh, he's really cool because he's violent. Do you know what I mean? But what does it really mean? Why do you think he's really cool? Because he's, I'm not saying, no disrespect to Paul.
Reading your book, it is a story of, like, you know, you got moved around a bit, and each time, and you're very honest about it. I love it. You know, you talk about, well, I wasn't going to be number one, but if I could be number two in terms of the biggest fighter in the school, with your John Wayne look.
Yeah.
You had to give your John Wayne look, and you had to face him out. And you admit very openly, as I would, you know, I've often got the bronze medal, not even the silver medal in the fight, mate. Look at the face. But you're very honest about that. And then you're very honest about the fact that, you know, because your dad really, you know, even though your dad was tough, but because he was drinking so much, he was becoming weaker and weaker. And your mother was always there for you, and she's still there for you now. And now maybe you're there for her more. Yeah. She's this guiding light that you've always had around you. Amazing. She sounds like an amazing lady. But that wasn't just symptomatic of your household. That was symptomatic of many households across the United Kingdom, right?
Absolutely.
It didn't just happen in industrial areas. It happened in farming or rural areas as well. If poverty and alcohol came together, kids suffered. Wives suffered generally, yeah.
Yeah, domestic violence, a lot of domestic violence. And also what happened there, Ross, definitely, we had a denial system. Like, we had a sort of justification and rationalization about drinking and about, oh, we work hard and we play hard. We are heavy drinkers. No one was really admitting back then, oh, we're alcoholics. You know, we're actually, like, powerless over this substance that we've got. You know, we've got this illness, really, that, you know, because of our low self-esteem, because we're sensitive, because we have no hope or future. We feel that we've got no hope or future, no sense of belonging, really. But what tended to happen then is there was just like people would do the same thing over and over again. They would maybe go, if they had a job, they'd go to work, come back on the Thursday, Friday night. They might give their wife their pay packet. They might not. They might go straight to the pub. And then they were there. And that's what it was like with my dad, is like he would just disappear. And what would happen is he would go on a binge, and then we would see him, and then he'd be in this sort of withdrawal. Eventually he'd be in the withdrawals, and then he would have the hallucinations and the cold turkey, really the DTs. And I witnessed that when I was really young. So I started to witness that when I was really young, like, so 5 or 6 years old, I'd be, because I remember getting really freaked out, like frightened, like him walking up and down one night and he was starting to hallucinate.
He's seeing snakes and he's seeing spiders, and he's seeing your mum's mother staring at him.
My dead grandma, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you saw the same things. So even witnessing that did not in any way deter you from the path that you were on. In fact, you started drinking his special brew when he passed out, right? Because you thought it was cool. Because you thought it was cool.
Because I thought, and what happened with that first can of special brew, as I drank that back, I remember identifying inside myself there was no feelings. My feelings, my thoughts and my feelings were quashed. And I could I felt like the glow of the special brews that hit the receptor sites in the brain. And then I thought, this must be what it's like to be normal, right? So therefore, and I had that, it was really poignant sort of thought, this must be what it's like to be normal. So therefore, I felt abnormal from quite a young age. I felt defective, like there was something wrong with me. I was flawed. And the special brew just worked. It worked. It was like fruit on a tree that was ripe for addiction. When I took that, you know, like as soon as I took that special brew, it was like, oh, this is the solution. Right? Not that I wanted, because of my dad's alcoholism, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. But so when drugs came along later on, I took to them like a duck to water, because I could stay in denial about it. I wasn't an alcoholic, but I could be an addict.
Which sounds mad, but absolutely it made total sense at the time, right? Because that's where you were. Can incidents in your childhood set off a chain of events that will lead you to addiction?
Well, I think early exposure, right? I think trauma, some type of, so where the amygdala is getting, so we're in the brain, obviously, I've got the amygdala, the fight, flight, freeze, fawn response. And I think with my relationship with my dad from a young age, where there was this inconsistency, there was this volatility that at any moment he could just go crazy.
Bang, yeah.
And I was always beside the door, Ross. I was always like my shoes off. I'd never take my shoes off. You know, like I'd always be beside the door looking all the time, watching every sort of mannerism really of him in case it's danger, isn't it? You know, there's a guy, a friend of mine wrote a book and he talks about, he thinks that addicts, like when there was back in hunter-gatherer times, we would have been the watchers of the tribe. We would have been like, the gatekeepers of the tribe, because we're so sensitive and we're so perceptive around potential danger. So I think what happens in the brain, and it happened for me, was because of that heightened amygdala response, which then is on a lot of the time, whereas people don't, you know, like generally, you know, if it's only like maybe a car comes really fast beside us, then we get that sense of danger. But if you're around a situation which is traumatic, which is dangerous a lot of the time, your amygdala is continually switched on. And what's coming with that is you're getting a high in the reward system. I've got some of that. And then coupled with early exposure to drugs. So 15, you know, the brain's not fully formed, isn't it? You know, at that point, earlier than that, I'm drinking. Earlier than that, I'm starting to act out in addictive behaviours to look for attention. So already setting yourself up with the sort of dangerous role models, really. So those factors, early exposure, trauma, and then maybe a genetic factor.
But you went from alcohol to smoking cannabis.
Yeah.
How old were you when you first smoked cannabis?
I was 15, right, which is still a wee bit later, right, than most, you know, because there's a lot of guys in Glasgow back then didn't do the sort of textbook progression of going through various drugs, went straight to shooting up heroin, you know, pre-puberty, right? So they've not even hit, because we develop, isn't it, like, as, you know, as human beings, as when we're 14, 15, 16, we go through puberty, we've got all the hormones rushing through the body, so we're developing skills and resources internally, how to deal with life and creating this. So if you're already starting to numb out on heroin, say a really, you know, highly addictive substance is heroin, painkiller, best painkiller in the world, and you're already doing that when you're 14 years old, right? You've got no resilience, right? So you start using at 14, then you say, hopefully you get clean whenever, say you get clean at 30, you're stuck. Your emotional development is stuck at a 14-year-old, but you're in a 32-year-old man's body. So you get into a relationship when you're 32 years old, you're clean, but you're a 14-year-old kid. You know what I mean? Really, because you've not went through all the things that people go through in life, breakups in relationship, people dying, trying to get a job, not succeeding, failures. You know, if you're just numbing all the time with heroin or alcohol, it doesn't matter really what the substance, does it? I mean, I'm just using heroin as an example.
But you're basically not, you're not present.
You're not present. You're not growing. You're not, look, and if it's like everything in life, isn't it? If it's not growing, it's decaying or it's stagnant, you know? So like what happens there is you're stuck at that emotional age. And, you know, obviously then you're going into every experience with the mind of a 14 or a 15-year-old teenager, really. What are 15-year-old teenagers? I mean, I've got two teenagers. I mean, like, so, like, would I trust them to me?
Do you talk to them? I mean, the great thing about you is, Mark, is you're very self-deprecating. You tell the truth, and we get onto some really interesting stories in a minute. But do you talk to them about addiction and drugs?
What I've got with them definitely is that I have an open sort of communication with them, that they feel, I think they trust that they can say anything to me and that I can help them.
Right. And what would your advice be, even to me, because I've been exposed to drugs. I mean, we grow up and we've been, and I've been, you know, all over the world and we made £3.5 million worth of cocaine one afternoon in the Rye Valley with Shining Path. Yeah, and I know you've done equally mad things. You know, you come home and you find cocaine in your kid's pocket.
Yeah.
And they're 14. How do you play that one?
I know. Well, you'd sit down. What I would do if I was in that situation, I'd make some time, I'd say, right, okay, and I'd sit my son down and my daughter down, and I'd say, look, I found the cocaine, right? I wouldn't beat around. I'd say, look, I found the cocaine.
Did I go for your pocket, son? But I wouldn't have been, you know, but I did, and that's it, sorry.
I found, and I've got it now, and look, and, you know, and I can say, look, I'm sorry about that, this is how I got to that point, but ultimately, okay, tell me about what it is, like, what's your relationship like with it? What is it that you're doing? You know, what is it you're doing? How much are you using it? Is it just been given to you just off chance, a friend had it? Or is it something that we together should need to be concerned about? You know, like, but in a way that it's like, okay, so how do we resolve? If it is, but it might just be, obviously, it's a one-off thing, and it just happened.
Yeah. Because if you go too heavy, you push away. They push.
Oh, no, wait. You don't want to do that. And you don't want to come across punitive, Ross. You don't want to come across.
No way, man.
I'm going to punish you for having this. Because then that creates right away defensiveness.
You're pushing it under. You're pushing it away. You're making it hide it, right?
Because you've only got certain windows. What I realise about this, a lot of times we're working with clients, is, you know, there's often only, there's a window of opportunity where you can sort of get on, you can sort of like, where somebody's a bit more vulnerable or somebody's receptive to talking about it. And it's about being able to identify the window, and then, because once that's closed, it's really difficult because you're met with an ego, you know, and certainly what I find is it's always got to be done one-to-one, you know, like with any, you know, that it's not done in a forum where the child or so, or anyone, the adult, feels shame, or because they're trying to protect their ego really around it because there's other people listening. So it's a delicate one as well, isn't it? How do you take all that into consideration, like that? What's likely to get the best response, isn't it? What's my approach to this that's likely to get the best response?
But overall, what you're saying, your advice is it shouldn't be punitive. It should be, let's talk about this. Let's work out, is it an occasional thing? You're doing it with your friends.
Do you need to
take this every week? Where are we? And please, let's talk about it, because if we can talk about it, then we got a better understanding of it, I guess. And then, and every case and every individual, and you know this better than me, is individual. We're none of us, we're all unique and none of us are the same. Let's talk a bit more about you, mate. So
yeah,
you have this pretty, I mean, it is kind of textbook, you know, hard Glaswegian childhood.
Yeah.
But you sort of like, yeah, with the John Wayne look.
Aye, but
yeah. You like the idea of becoming Glasgow's Pablo Escobar, don't you, really?
Yeah.
You've got it into your head. And, you know, you meet Claire, the kind of posh English girl.
Yeah.
She falls in love with you, fall in love. You start traveling. But everything is sort of related to or connected to narcotics.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. But you're mixing lots of things because you're into the spiritualism. You're into the gangsterism, yeah, aren't you? And there's a lot of things, there's a lot of conflicting things going on there, man.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, they were mixed with something else, which was, you were highly dependent by this point.
Yeah.
You were smoking, I mean, you were smoking a lot of hash,
loads,
right?
Of cannabis, yeah, loads of cannabis every day, and the best quality from the, look, the quality now, the THC that the kids are smoking, that's why lots of the young people are developing mental health.
We'll come to that.
Brilliant, man. Right. Okay. So I am.
There's you. It's the mid 80s, right?
Mid 80s. Yeah. Been up in the mountains, been in the Himachal Pradesh, been right into the villages, right? Where the sort of, they're called untouchables, but not untouchables, but basically you can't, they're not untouchables. They're Brahman. They're Brahman, but we can't touch any of the parts of the village. We can't touch the people. We can't even pay for the biscuit. We've got to put the money on the little counter that they've got, and the chillum you have to pick up from the ground, you know. And
chillum being
the chillum's kind of, the pipe the smoke guy. They all,
and you smoke the cannabis from that, yeah. The resin.
You basically load the chillum with tobacco. You it's like a cone. All it is like a cone. It's made of clay. The best ones are made in a place called Pondicherry in India. As I reach for the chillum this morning with Claire, I'll go on. I can talk about them villages and stuff as well, because they were mad times. But that. She said to me, she says, you love, and you know, like sometimes you get this really strong, and somebody says something to you and you're just a bit more conscious than you are normally, and it leaves an impression. And she said to me, you love hashish more than you love me. And of course I said, of course I don't, Claire, I love you more than that in the world, you know, some type of comment like that. But actually, it resonated in me, and I thought, of course I love hash. Of course I love hash more than I love her, because this is the top of the tree. Like, the addiction is there's no room really for much else, really, apart from feeding the addiction, finding ways and means to get more of it, really. As much as you might want to have, you know, and I did, and I obviously, when I did meet Claire at the beginning, I fell in love with her, I met her in France, you know, but really, really, if I had to choose, you know, my addiction or Claire, it would have been my addiction.
The addiction eventually will overtake all, yeah?
All.
When did you, going back to you, when did you decided, I don't know, I'm going to be the Chapo Guzman, I'm going to be the Pablo Escobar, you know, of Scotland, you realised that, just like many people, Curtis Warren, for instance. I mean, he realised, for those of us that don't know, he was one of the first guys, Liverpudlian, that worked out, if I go to where they make it and bring it back myself, or get somebody else eventually to bring it back for me, I make a huge profit because I cut out the variant middlemen who are all taking a slice of the profits.
Yeah.
And that's what you, in your own way, that's, I mean, by your own, you know, by your own description, you know, nothing to declare, you know, it's how, you know, confessions of an unsuccessful drug smuggler, because the ones that are successful, we don't really know who they are, do we?
Yeah. But I think even the successful ones, I think they can't, right, so this depends on whether or not, I think what my experience is, the successful ones, they just keep doing it.
Because there's so much money. I mean,
so much money. So much money. You're
talking about you can't get rid of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you're doing it on a bigger scale, look, these guys that I was working with back then, the Irish guys, they were making amphetamine sulfate, right? Now, this is back in 86. And so they were making it here in this country. In fact, the Leuchart reaction. It was like a 7-hour process, bathtub, just filling it into a bathtub, really. And they were making the speed. So the outlay, really, would be to get the BMK, the various chemicals that they need. The outlay was very little. Eventually they started doing it in farms and stuff. But then, say they would make 40 kilos or 50 kilos of speed. So it might cost them, say, like £10,000 to make it, right? But then they've got 50 kilos, right? They sell each kilo for £2,000. That's £100,000. But they can't sell 50 kilos at that strength. They've got to cut it. So they've got to put an adulterant in there and make it. So they make it from 50 into 150, right? So then we're starting to look at the numbers. Then you're talking 300 grand. £300,000 on a 10 grand investment. I mean, where do you get, and they're doing that, they can do that, you know, if they've got the networks, the sophisticated criminal networks, especially, you know, if you're supplying the whole of the UK with amphetamine sulfate, you're the top of the tree, saying you're doing that, you know, you're making that amount. I mean, I used to walk into these guys' houses and there would just be money everywhere, bags of money. And I'd be sitting there and there'd be guns and there'd be, you know, like there'd be a shotgun, usually a shotgun at the door, and then just lots and lots of money. And so the profits are just...
Did that generate your inner will to go and start smuggling?
Well, what started to happen then is because you surround yourself, we become like our environment. I mean, like I guess what happens here, isn't it? This applies really in recovery as well, about the friends that I have in recovery and about who I aspire to. So in recovery, in recovery from addiction and like just my daily life, I always try and do better. And lots of that I think about, a lot of my friends, not necessarily are successful, but maybe what they do, they've been driven, or they're goal orientated, or they want to achieve a particular thing, and they push themselves. And what happens to me when I'm around people like that inspires me. Instead of having envy for them, the opposite envy is admiration. So I admire. I say, oh well, what's the positive qualities, and you know, what is it that I see in them that, you know, they're achieving whatever goals is.
Talk about Nick. Nick was a guy that used to go, did a lot of acid, right?
And yeah, yeah.
You bump into him all over, you bump into India, you know, he's on a rap, he goes off to India. You meet him in India. You met a lot of people that you knew had all done this runner to India, and they were all involved with this same sort of idea, of getting high, but also of making plenty of money by trying to import stuff through. And for some, like Ross or Rossi, your mate, it went horribly wrong, right? As it did for you, eventually. As it probably does for most people who are working in that area.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you think if you'd been totally clean, Mark,
yeah,
you would have been more successful?
Yeah, that's a really, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because look, we've got to always think about, you know, Jack, would I be, it's a commodity, isn't it? Like, it's like any type of sale, you know, like if you buy a product, you know, like if you think of it, if it had been, say, silk or something in India that I was buying and bringing that across, I could have been maybe equally successful, and or not that I was successful, but I could have, if I had those skills, those entrepreneurship skills, then I could have just applied it to something else. I just happened to apply it to something that was illegal and really ultimately very destructive for me because I got chemically addicted to it. But if I had been clean, look, my friend went off when I was, many years ago, and he said, this was way back, he had a really good business around bike couriers, so he used to drop off parcels, all like kilos and kilos of dope, all around London, and he had about six guys all working for him. And at one point, and he was a PhD student, right, at the time he was doing a PhD, and he was like, and he was purely smoked cannabis, didn't take any other drugs, and he was very like thoughtful and considered in a lot of his sort of thinking, I guess. And he said, just as the rave scene was starting, he says, I'm going to go and I'm going to use the money that I've made to get a club in Barcelona, and then I'm going to get some clubs. And as far as I know, he just transferred all that money into the clubs, you know. I don't know whatever happened to that guy, but I often think, yeah, he had a different, he was a bit less impulsive. He was a bit less,
he was a two marshmallow guy.
I guess we'll come back to that.
It's going to be a new analogy. It's going to be a new analogy for me. Got to try and be a two marshmallow guy rather than that one in marshmallow guy. And that was, do you think that was part of the problem again, Mark? You know, you're up in the mountains, you're not allowed to touch anything.
Yeah,
so you do, they claim you're touching something, but you're going to go and see a man and you're going to buy,
yeah,
what you've always read about in your book. You had your little book, did you? You had your,
it was called The Great Books of Hashish, and The Great Books of Hashish had in every page, it had a different country. So you had like from Nepal, you had Nepalese temple balls. From Lebanon, you had red, gold, hashish. So you had these beautiful pictures, right? And then a story, a narrative underneath about, you know, what part of the country you get the drugs from, right? So then it would go into Charis from Manali or Malana. And so I had it like, okay, in my mind, this is where I've got to get. So when we'd be sitting around, this is like, so years before, we'd be always sitting there listening to Hot Winder, you know, listening to Roy Harper or something, and they would all be talking about, they'd be making reference to the great books of hashish and saying, oh, we're all going to be in Lebanon, we're all going to be, I remember saying to myself, yeah, but you guys are like not, you're just smoking weed and you're smoking dope and you're going to procrastinate, I'm going to get there, I'm definitely going to get, so there was,
when you got there, when you got in the room and you saw it,
Oh, it was like Christmas, Ross. It's like, you know, I remember sitting in that room with Sitaram, right? And I looked, he took me, right? So I'm in this little wooden, it's a wooden house in a place called Malana. Malana's the highest, it's the best of that whole area. It's renowned. The Italian hippies were always saying, like, get to Malana. Malana's the best charis. It's creme de la creme of charis. So I get to I get there and I get into his house, and Sitaram comes in and he says, okay, how much? I mean, the first time it was only a couple of kilos. I think it was about 3 kilos the first time. But he says, what do you want? And I say, 3 kilos. And then he goes, okay, come on in here. And I'm sitting with these other hippies who are all smoking chillums, and my friend's whacked, you know, he's tired because he's a bit overweight, and we've been climbing this mountain. I mean, it's a serious trek as well. It's snow covered mountains. You're trekking for 9 hours, you know, and then away down the other side, it's really steep. You've got your rucksack behind you. I get down to the bottom of the village, and then I can't touch the houses. But I get into the house, the main house, and he says, come in here. And then I look from the top, from the ceiling, really, right away down to the floor. It's, you know, blocks, big blocks of charis. Like that, big blocks, just on top of one another. And in my mind, I'm looking, I'm thinking, how much is here? There must be like 200.
You're converting it.
To money.
Yeah, you're converting it into pound sterling.
Aye, yes. It's £2,000. It's 2,500 a kilo. There's got to be 300 kilos just in this room alone. Do you know what I mean? So what we're talking about, 600,000, at least 600,000, 750,000. We've got nearly 1 million just in this room. But to him, it's worth £75 a kilo. You know what I mean? It's not worth 2,000. To him, he lives on a pound a day, you know, on rice and sabji and dal and chapati. You know, it's like, for him, it's nothing really. It's like peanuts. It's, you know, but for me, I know, all right, in London, and also the kudos, the you know, that I would get from getting it back as well.
Was that part of it? Was it part of it?
Definitely.
It's like, I have been up the mountain and I've been driven on the other side. I have managed to get this.
Yeah.
I have duped customs. I've duped governments. And also, I'm making a profit. So what was it about the profit, was it? It was
about the entire...
It's about an adrenaline, and that's something that's always been a part of your nature. It's a part of your nature now, isn't it? You like your motorcycles, you like climbing, you like doing all those things
that
give you that. And when you were younger, you like to jump from roof to roof.
Yeah. It's adrenaline. But now I've got to be really careful, because now the difference being I've got two wonderful children, right, teenagers, and I've got to get the balance. I've got to. So when I'm on that bike, which I was a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to be on it tomorrow morning, and I'm like going along the motorway, the M25 or whatever it is, and it's a sports, so it's 180, it's a Fireblade, so they, you know, seriously fast bikes. But I then go to myself, look, I've got two, it flashes in front of me, those faces of my children, as I'm passing them, maybe a lorry or something, it flashes, and what happens in that moment is I go, it's not about me anymore, it's about them. I want to be here for the foreseeable, I want to be here in my 80s. I want to see them getting married, you know, if they're getting married or they don't get married or get kids. I want to be here for the rest of the, well, as long as I can be.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. And the difference is when I was younger, but not to say I don't have mad moments. When I was doing the paragliding recently, I got like a bit of a, what am I doing up here, man? This is nuts. Like I was hitting thermals and I got...
Yeah, I've done that, man. You keep going up, you want to come down, yeah.
Aye.
And no matter which way you pull the toggle, you keep going up. Yeah,
aye.
Yeah.
You've done it. It's funny, isn't it?
That's what you also, if you're on a kind of resort, which I was in Switzerland, I started looking at the rig and seeing how few of the actual lines that were supposed to be coming up from the seat that I was in and the ship were not attached. Anyway, that's another story. I want to talk about you. So I want to talk about, you start becoming a proper drug smuggler. And with that goes, hey, it's a lot of adrenaline, but there goes a lot of risks. It's not just the authorities that you've got to deal with. You've got to deal with the other criminals.
The criminals. And the biggest, and with that, Ross, right, this is what we've got here. My fear a lot of time was not the police or not the authorities, because in my mind, I had worked out, you know, like stashing the money, like putting the money in different bank accounts that couldn't be, so making sure that the assets couldn't be frozen, or so you can work out a plan. You've got a strategy around, okay, well, you know, because you've got, it comes, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. You know that you're doing this action, the likely consequences if you get caught, or if you walk through customs and excise and you get 5 kilos or 10 kilos or whatever you've got in your bag, the likelihood is if it's Heathrow, you're going to get this amount of time in prison. If you go through Amsterdam, so you're doing all these, it's all calculated risks, isn't it? You're like going, well, Amsterdam, what's the likelihood? It's all gamble. It's all like a gambler, really, isn't it?
And again, that's addictive.
Oh, really? Because Ross, see the high that you get when you get through in that moment. You think, what's happening? Exactly the same thing as when I was a little boy, my amygdala was getting triggered. Right, with my dad feeling that, like when I escaped or ran away from, I got away from his grip, I felt that I got the rush from the chase, or him pursuing me, but then I'm safe, right? Which is another high as well. So what would happen with that? As soon as I got through the customs, and I'm actually throughout the airport and then down on the tube or in a taxi, as soon as I've left and I know I'm safe, right? I've got all my suitcase and it's fine. The buzz from that was like, but then what happens is I've never had it any other way where after I've got away, I've thought I could have had another 5 in there. I could have had another 10. I could have had, because look, I've already got through. So what would it, I should have taken a higher risk. I should have just bought 30 kilos instead of 10 kilos, or, you know, it's like, it's always, there's always that sense of more, I want more. I've not got enough if you're an addict.
You spent time in prison, haven't you?
Yeah, just in Spain, and Alarin del Toro in Malaga, and that in itself, and also in Belmarsh, that's when we were talking the last time, isn't it, about Belmarsh, and that was just a small remand set at the time. And so, I was incredibly, if we're looking at, you know, prison time, and for the things that I'd done and the lifestyle that I led, I was incredibly fortunate that I never got caught for loads of the things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, in Thailand or in Malaysia, definitely get the death penalty.
That's what I was going to say to you, because you smuggled hash into Thailand.
Into Thailand, yeah.
A lot of it.
Yeah.
There's no question there, particularly in that time.
Yeah,
you'd have been hung, right?
I think so. Or you might have been lucky if you got the embassy to come in and got some type. I don't know. I mean, I really.
It'd have been life, though, wouldn't it?
Life in a Thai prison.
But to be in the position you are now,
yeah,
which is where you help people who are addicted. Yeah. When you were at the height of your addiction, and you were dealing, did it ever cross your mind that you were harming other people?
Right, brilliant point. Yeah, so I think I would have, right? I think I did, but I think I justified. I think what happened to me, and probably what happens to a lot of people is they justify in their head, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will do it. Somebody's always going to, you know, pick this up. And also the drive to get the money or the drive to get more of the drugs. I guess, if you're looking at conscience, a healthy, somebody with a healthy sense of, a healthy value system or conscience, as the Catholics would have called it, is like, they would go, well, no, this is causing harm. This is, could cause harm to me. It causes harm to others, and their self-esteem, because they've got a value system, they say, well, I'm not going to do anything that's going to harm me. I'm not going to do a partner behavior that continues to harm me or continues to harm others. But I think addicts, right, because their self-esteem is so low, they just do it over and over again, because there's no love for themselves. They don't have any love for themselves. They've not got the ability to show love to themselves. So therefore, how can they show love to other people? This is the biggest thing about the whole recovery process and learning to love someone else or learning to love other people.
But let's deglamorize this a bit, because we've talked about the sort of glamorize the smuggling, but the awful reality of it, particularly like if you become
an addict
of something like heroin, is that there is no glamour attached to that.
No, listen.
You've lived that life.
Aye.
Give me an example of what it was like to live on the streets of London as an addict.
So let's go straight to that. So get away. The ego gets deflated. I've not got any prestige or kudos because I'm not a drug smuggler anymore. No money. I'm a street addict. So I'm surviving every day on either a gyro or stealing butcher meat or stealing razor blades. I mean, I'm just thinking about low-level petty crime to subsidise a habit, or I'm selling heroin to get my heroin for free.
You know what? I was going to ask you,
and
I've decided not to, what it feels like to shoot up for the first time. I'd rather hear what it's like to be sick when you can't get what your body says it needs.
Well, you're desperate because every cell in your body, I mean, and I think more so than it is for alcohol withdrawal. I'm not saying DTs is not horrendous as well, but with heroin...
Some people argue that one is worse than the other. I think it probably depends on who you are and what position you're in, I guess.
Yeah. And absolutely, right. And so what it feels like is every cell in your body is craving for the chemical that if you get it into you, you're not going to be sick anymore, and you're not getting, and this is it, you're not getting high anymore like you used to get high, where the heroin, I shouldn't get into that, but basically,
it's not having a pleasurable effect. What it is getting you normal. People say getting straight.
All you're doing is you're getting the heroin just to feel normal. So then you're going out. Say you're going out and you're shoplifting, or say you're going shoplifting. What it was like for me when I was shoplifting, I'd go into, say, Oxford Street or wherever, and I'd go into a John Lewis and I'd be going to steal something, just clothes or whatever it might be, and I would know that I'm going to get caught, because the likelihood is you stick out like a sore thumb. You're an addict. You're sweating. You look grubby. So I'd know that I'm powerless because I need the money. Because I'm sick as a dog. I'm actually maybe physically sick as well. I'm actually vomiting. I've got loads of mucus. I'm sweating. I'm getting hot and cold flushes. The whole cold turkey thing comes from the chicken thing, isn't it? It's like you have like pimples of like where you're just one minute you're really, really hot and you're sweating profusely. Next minute you're really cold. And then you've got no energy, right, to get from... It's a bit like, you know, we've got the COVID going on here now, and I'm not saying it's similar to the virus, but I would say like flus, where the nearest I get to it when I've had a flu, that would be like what it's like having the symptoms of withdrawal. But of course, you can't sleep, and it goes on for days. Like, so when you can't sleep, you know, like for 5-6 days. So then you get the sleep deprivation, then you get the paranoia.
Also, you're living and you're either in love with, maybe at some point, other addicts. So you have formed relationships. You're in this kind of horrible melting pot where, as we talked earlier again about the addiction, ultimately, you're only ever going to love one thing, and it isn't going to be you. It's not you, and it's not the people around you, because you're all fighting for one thing, aren't you?
Yeah, you're all wanting heroin. And if you're in codependent relationships, it's like the crab bucket, right? Any crab that tries to get out the bucket, the other crabs pull them back down. It's like that. That's exactly what it's like. So as soon as somebody says, listen, I'm going to go and get clean, or say the person does start to go and get clean, what you find is the other people start to offer them drugs. They might
come
never...
Come back. Be like me.
Because you're shining a mirror.
So Mark, part of the Kempcast and being a guest on the Kempcast is to help people who listen in to not only understand how you overcame your toughest moment, but also help them with advice should they be facing something similar in the future. So I know you've been strangled out in Lima by robbers. You've had guns thrust in your face, mate. you tried to kill yourself numerous occasions with drugs. What's been the toughest moment for you, and how did you overcome that toughest moment?
Yeah, the toughest moment, Ross, was definitely at the end, and the end was in this toilet in St. Thomas's Hospital. And previous to that, the context of it is that for maybe about a year, I was like, I was really lonely. I'd like a lot of the people associated with were not friends. They're just, what happens is you gravitate towards other people who are addicts, and but there's no depth to those relationships. It's just getting and finding ways and means to get more drugs or alcohol. Oh God, the time around when the end of my using with my friend in that toilet in St. Thomas's Hospital was my rock bottom. I'd say that night was my rock bottom.
What happened?
And the rock bottom was because he gave me, John, his name was John, gave me some diamorphine. He was HIV positive. Back then you could, if you were a heroin addict back in 92, 93, 94, you could, if you're a heroin addict and you had HIV, they used to give you diamorphine amps, like, which is just heroin, pure heroin in an ampoule form. So I go with him to the hospital. He gives me an amp. I shoot it up in the toilet. I slightly go over. I've not overdosed, but I go into almost like an overdose. But I come out of it and the toilet's, right, so I'm in the toilet. The toilet's light's been put off. So when I come to, it's completely dark. So I immediately think I've lost my sight, right? Because, but then I'm like sort of like on this toilet and then I look down and I see a glimmer of light at the bottom, which is underneath the door of the door in that hospital, the toilet door. And I see like, and then I come out, I follow the light, and then I see the light on the wall, and I put the light on, and I go back into the cubicle, and I am basically crying out inside from my spirit, like really, like if there's anything there, please help me, right? Please, if there is a God, I really need you to help me, and. You know, and I'm in the rock bottom. I'm thinking, I've got suicidal ideation. I don't want to commit suicide because I mean, my pride was like saying, what would people think about me if I committed suicide? I mean, it's a bit late. You're already dead, you know. But that sort of, like, so my, like, I couldn't bring myself to killing myself. But yet at the same time, so that night, I cried out. I didn't go down and kneel on the floor and do that. But I just sat in that toilet and I just. And then after that, a sequence of events happened where I wound up getting arrested. I wound up getting sent to Belmarsh. And it was the beginning of me applying for treatment to go into a rehab, really. And then if I fast forward 6 years later, I'm in that same hospital. My child has just been born, Finn. I'm upstairs. I'm with my partner at the time. I look at my son. I'm elated. Apart from being clean, the next best thing ever that I've ever done that I'm proud of is being a father, right? So when I witnessed him being born, I came back downstairs and I went into that same toilet and I looked in the mirror at the man.
Same toilet.
Same toilet. And I remember the cubicle and I looked across, there's the cubicle. That's where I sat 6 years ago in absolute pain, wanted to kill myself, complete dereliction, emotional, bankrupt, you know, spiritually, mentally bankrupt, you know, a shell of a man, right? And then I looked in the mirror and I'm just became a father. And I just thought, I am so happy, I'm elated. So to have both of those experiences in life in one life is like, most people never have that experience, that absolute rock bottom to this feeling of absolute, you know, feeling beautiful, you know, so happy. And I think that's where that's how I feel. I generally feel really grateful. I mean, and lots of people with addictions, because they've had such a hard, it's been, life was so difficult in the addiction, most things don't, I mean, things phase them, obviously, but when you reflect back on where you come from, you can't help but really count your blessings and thank God, because that's the alternative. The alternative is, and this is what spurs me on, you know, 23 and a half years, I'm nearly 24 years, I'll be 24 years clean in December the 4th this year. But what's happened in that time, I've buried my dad. My dad got 15 years. I helped my dad get sober. He's in sobriety. My cousin, I helped her get into sobriety. My mum doesn't, I mean, not that she was really an alcoholic, but she's got her son back. I've got two children that have never seen me take drink or drug that I've got such a strong connection with. I've got lovely, beautiful friends. I've got, you know, so there's, you know, I've got a good career. I've, you know, obviously wrote these books. I'm connected. I mean, there's so many blessings, you know, but what's on offer, if I decide to take a drink or a drug on the impulse and go, oh, well, things have changed and now I'm a therapist and I've got healthier self-esteem and that's what's on offer. Would I gamble all of the blessings just to have a couple of pints or to try and have a couple of pints in a social setting where who am I going to have it with? Anyway, all my pals are in recovery as well. Gosso and everybody, you know, it's like...
You would not, for all the goodness that you've now found in your life, those two drinks are not worth losing all of that.
Oh, never. Not in a million years.
Could you just outline for people who don't know what the 12 steps are? I know you have to be very careful about this. We're not going to touch on it in great detail. But just so people listening understand what the 12 steps essentially are.
12 steps is a program that was set up in initially from 1935 by really a broker. I call him a broker. Wasn't really a broker, but he worked in the financial industry back in 1935, and a doctor. And these two guys were alcoholics, and they realised that they couldn't stay sober on their own. But being together and talking to one another, they could stay sober.
But essentially, there are 12 stages that you have to fulfil, but you also have the support of a friend or friends.
Yeah.
And it's about shared experience and about creating understanding and about friendship and support.
Support, absolutely.
Is that it? I mean...
You're absolutely right. A sponsorship is a big part of it. So altruistic, I've done a bit of service this morning. So doing something for free, you know, giving of your time for free to support other alcoholics and addicts. The 12 steps are, it's like guidelines of how to live your life, because the first step is we are powerless over our addiction, that our life became unmanageable. Second step, we came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So there's a thing about God, you know, there is an influence of God within it, but not, there's lots of people who are atheists and agnostics who go to meetings and use. And then there's 12 steps right through. Part of the step process is an amend process, where you make a list of all the people you've harmed and then become willing to make amends to them. You do an inventory of yourself where you really examine yourself, your motivations, you look at relationships, you look at sexual relationships, you look at shame, guilt, fears. So you start to really...
You strip yourself away, do you? I mean...
Yeah.
You take yourself back to what was originally you before you became addicted, I guess.
That's it. You're trying to get in touch with your authentic self, who you really are, not who you think you are, not who, if you're in a relationship, who she thinks you are. You're trying to be to get to the real man or the real woman. And what are your, not my ego, not like who I think I am, you know, when I'm a drug dealer, a drug smuggler, or, you know, what's really going on under all that? What's the roots of it? The insecurity, the fear that I don't feel enough, so I've got to be somebody different.
I'm definitely guilty of it. I mean, I still drink, and you know, sometimes I drink too much, and hopefully I've got it under control. But I would say that I have used alcohol, particularly when I was younger, as a shield, as a barrier. whether it was to make myself feel more confident or whether it was to hide. Definitely.
Same here. Ross, I've definitely done.
You know, as somebody who has been involved with drugs in both sides and looks at it and helps people now, is there any way that you would say that the legalization of narcotics should be considered? Is it too impossible to enforce? Could it be enforced? And would it be across, would it be a blanket enforcement or would it be only certain types of narcotics?
I know. And how do you regulate it, right? And how do you then, private industry, right? Look at private, look, so then it becomes like Marlboro
cannabis,
And then we've got to consider, look, the THC, right, as back to this thing. Do you want to talk about that now? Right?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think I've noticed, and I've been obviously working in prisons lately, talking to a lot of people. I'm breaking into a cannabis factory, which was three terraced houses in Greenwich. The lights came on at different times. To all intents and purposes, there were three families living there. The windows were electrocuted. They took the power off the mains. All the plants in there were being kept at such a level. The female was being kept at such a level. The buds were humongous. And there was one kid in there, a Vietnamese kid. He had a bag of rice. He had some chicken stock, like chicken cubes. And that was all he had to eat, and tap water. And he would be replenished every 3 weeks by Mr. Big, whoever Mr. Big was, or Mr. Medium, actually. But, you know, the levels of THC are causing severe, and I would say severe mental health issues to a lot of young people, particularly
absolutely.
In the UK right now. Would you go along with
that? Totally. And when even years, so even when I was like manager of these drug services in Hackney, we used to go to the mental health units in Homerton Hospital, and we could see, and they could see that at least 50% of the young men, right, that were developing schizophrenia or bipolar, they were all skunk users. They were all smoking skunk. There is absolutely no doubt, right? If you've got a predisposing, if you've got a vulnerability to any mental health condition and you smoke THC, that 17 or 18%, the levels with no CBD in it, you're going to have a problem. So I think if we legalized, it's very different legalizing old school cannabis that was around the way back in the 80s, which was 6% or 7%, and it had CBD in it. And, you know, it's a different drug. This is a psychoactive drug.
Yeah, I know. And exactly. And I don't think it's ever going to happen. Well, not in my lifetime, because there are still a number of people out there that see it as a gateway drug. And I'm just talking about cannabis at the moment. And also, it's an incredibly big business, the war on drugs, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a big business.
It's a billion dollar business, isn't it?
I know. And you've got Breaking the Taboo. There was that film out. My friend was in it because it's a massive business. Even if we look at things like in Glasgow, the amount of money that's spent on treatment, right? And how much of that treatment's to do with pharmaceuticals. So really the pharmaceutical companies, like with methadone and stuff, basically, and the contracts that are given that are continually reinforced year after year. And say like the prison estate, you've been in the prison estate. So look, say we take Berlini Prison and we're
where basically nearly a tanker turns up with methadone once a week. People are sicking it up and selling it.
Right, that's it. That's exactly what happens, right? So how are we addressing, look, the outward addiction, the drug or the whatever chemical is used, that's not the problem. The problem is the addiction, right? If we don't deal with the underlying issue, right, we're just putting a plaster over, right? Methadone is methadone is not just a methadone is, if I was to come off, if I was to choose, if I was addicted, right, if you could make me addicted and say, look, you can either be addicted, Mark, to heroin or methadone, I'd far rather be addicted to heroin than methadone, because methadone takes so long to come out the system. It drags on for so long. So what we've got here in Berlini Prison, or all prison estates throughout the country, is we've got a whole group of guys that are you know, the 5% of the population are committing 95% of the crime. So we've got the acquisitive, we've got this group of people who are all like maybe street addicts, and they're committing the crime, they're going into the prison estate, and what's happening is they're getting put on a methadone, or they're putting, or they're taking spice, or they're taking, but nothing's really getting done to address the addiction.
Last question, Mark.
Hi.
And I thank you. It's great, mate. And you are a mate. But thank you for being so honest, brutally honest. Brutally honest, man. If there's anyone out there currently listening to the podcast or possibly watching it, looking to beat addiction, what advice would you give them?
Yeah. What I'd say, Ross, like, guys, if there's any or girls out there, 12-step, there's lots of 12-step fellowships. For every single drug that is out there, there's a 12-step fellowship for that, which I mean is that there's lots of different 12-step fellowships. You just need to look online and you'll see them. Also, your local drug and alcohol services, if you've got a problem, or if it's gambling, it could admit, I mean, I'm talking about drugs and alcohol, but it might be a behavioural addiction, it might be gambling, it might be sex, it might be sex and love, it might be codependency, it might be workaholism, it might be gaming, whatever your addiction is and that you want to change, there's a 12-step fellowship for that, but there's also services out there that you can go along to and you can connect in with and just say, look, I need help with this, please, can you help me?
The first thing you would say is you've got to pick the phone up. You've got to start talking.
You've got to ask.
And a bit of acknowledging, yeah?
Acknowledge that you've got a problem and acknowledge that you want to change it. And also understand that you can achieve this. Like, listen, addiction, you don't have to die being an addict. There's lots of us out there who've overcame addictions and changed their life. And really, you know, there's loads of success stories, you know, so just know that you can achieve it, you know, I would love to just sort of zap some hope into anybody who's listening to say, look, if I can do it, you can do it. Believe me, if I can beat addiction and or break addiction a day at a time for all these years, you can do it as well. Believe me.
Mark, thank you very, very much.
Yeah, it's great, Ross. It's great.
You're a fantastic guy.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater and the Chance of Collective production. Thanks to the team and One Fine Play. And until the next episode, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.